From the ACLU, this is At Liberty, and my name is Debbie Kamau Bell. Welcome back to the show. Hey, everybody, it's me, Kamau. You may recognize me from 7 seasons of CNN's United States of America. We won 4 Emmys. Or you may recognize me from my 4-part docuseries about Bill Cosby. We won a Peabody. Or you may recognize me from just the ACLU. I do the commercials on your cable news networks. They've never won awards. My dad's very proud. And I was on this podcast as a guest in 2019. But bigger than that, I've been the ACLU's artist ambassador for racial justice for 11 years. Yeah, who knew? My dad's very proud of that. Also, my mom, too. But that's neither here nor there. I am excited to be the new host for the podcast At Liberty through the end of the year. We're just going to see what happens with this whole America experiment. Until then, twice a month, I'll be bringing you conversations with leaders, legal experts, and storytellers who are dedicated to the fight for civil rights and civil liberties. We love all those things. And right now, today, I'm excited to share a conversation live from the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. In case you don't know what the city of brotherly love is, this is part of the ACLU's Know Your Rights bus tour. This month, the ACLU hit the road with artists, influencers, advocates, and community members to host events in 6 cities to make sure that voters know their rights and have a voting plan. Make sure you know your rights and also have a voting plan. For our stop in Philly, I sat down with Mike Lee, executive director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. Mike is Philly born and raised. We talked about that. And he has a long history of championing criminal justice reform and challenging discrimination against marginalized communities in the state. We talked about that too. We also talked about his perfect day. Anyway, check it out. Please welcome executive director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania, Mike Lee! Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So first of all, seems like some people in here maybe might be familiar with your work. Is that true?
One or two, yes. Okay. You are correct.
So as somebody, I lived in Philly for a little bit when I went to college here, and Philly always brings me back. I think Philly means a lot of things to a lot of people, especially people born and raised here. Give me your schedule for your perfect Philly day. What's the temperature? What time of year is it? What are you doing that day? What's that day like?
Oh, perfect Philly day. This is easy. It'll start around, well, I have 2 children and one is under 1. So it'll probably start around 5:30 a.m.
I said perfect. I didn't say the day.
So, all right, on the perfect day, I get up closer to 7 a.m.
Ooh, sleeping in.
That's right.
Yeah.
Come down to some Scrapple. You remember that from when you was at UPenn?
I remember Scrapple, yeah.
That's right.
And for people who are listening to the podcast, what is Scrapple?
It's hard to define. It is.
I love that you're probably an expert in the law, but Scrapple, you're like, I don't know if I can do that one. I don't know if I can do that.
Well, we only got like 30 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
But at the end of the day, Scrapple is what they are left with at the end of the day at the butcher, I suppose.
Yeah.
And they kind of boil it down into a grayish material, let it congeal, probably with some lard of some sort.
Yeah.
Then it gets cold, and before you eat it, it usually gets fried.
Man, this is sounding delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the morning. But let me skip to the best part of my perfect day.
Okay.
Because one of the reasons I'm up at 7 is because I need to get my spot at Broad Street for the Sixers championship parade that'll be on my perfect day. So
I love the fact that you've skipped all the way through the championship series. You don't want to see them win. You just want to be at the parade.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Right up in the front so everybody can see me at the parade.
Yeah.
So anybody try to say they had a better seat, I'd knock that chip off their shoulder.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, yeah, the perfect day would include a Sixers parade, which means we talk in June. Which means we also talk in soft pretzels and water ice season.
All right.
So I'm gonna enjoy that perfect day parade with a soft pretzel, some water ice, and wrap it up with some good family and friends. And the perfect day will end with another Roots picnic over on the Mann Center.
So the same day that the Sixers have their championship parade, the Roots also are having their picnic. Seems like bad scheduling, but sure, it's your perfect day. That could happen. That could happen. I believe that.
Yeah.
That the Roots crew would do that.
And then before I go to sleep, the governor of Pennsylvania will mysteriously find the courage to all of a sudden give $150+ million for indigent defense and another I'm just throwing that number out there. And even more money for public education. And then I'll go to sleep happy.
Then you go to sleep happy. I love that your perfect day, you were thinking about the people. I love that. So where does that come from for you? Where does that, you know, how do you come to this work? Is it, was this your family was doing this too? Or how do you come to this work?
I think we all have different roles in the movement, right? And my family didn't have a direct role per se, but they led by example. And my mom was a public school teacher here in Philadelphia for over 25 years. And my dad was an attorney, actually, and he was one of the first African-American partners at a large firm in Philadelphia. And I kind of combined their experiences to educate on the law. And one of the things that I like summarize from what my parents taught me is, it's cool to be first, but if you're not mentoring and giving back, you're going to find yourself being the last. And you know, what good is it to be the first if you're the only? So it's very important for me to make sure that other people are able to reach their potential the same way I had people help me start to reach my potential.
All right. And so your dad, well, you said he was the first African-American lawyer at, where was it?
Well, he was one of the first African-American attorneys to reach the level of partner.
Okay.
And he was at a firm called Wolf Block. But dig this. In 1971, I want to say, there was something called the Liacourt Committee in Pennsylvania. And it turns out, you'll be surprised to find this because I know you study a lot of racism, but Pennsylvania has
a racist past. That is my hobby, yes, it's my hobby, yeah.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania has a racist past, and that includes who they allowed to be admitted to practice the bar exam, or practice law, 2 per year. And the Liacourt Committee exposed that this is racist in denying the Commonwealth of many talented lawyers of color.
So they were only allowing 2 black people per year to take the bar?
To pass the bar, you know? So you had to conclude your picture on the bar exam, and only 2 people that would look like us would pass for whatever reasons.
So it didn't matter what your score was on the bar exam, we already got our 2 blacks.
I wasn't around then, but I heard that's how it works.
Yeah.
So this committee happened, exposed this racism, and my dad was admitted to practice the 2nd year after that racist thing ended. And since 1973, you've seen more and more and more African-American and attorneys of color in Pennsylvania.
Was it your dad being an attorney that led you to want to be a lawyer?
It led me to want to not be a lawyer for a long time.
That's how that works usually.
And I actually have a very circumventive way to want to be a lawyer. My dream job is to be the GM for the 76ers.
And I'm sensing a theme, yes.
I was looking one day to see what it would take. And it was either be a former NBA player, and I was already 26 at the time, or be a lawyer. So I applied to law school. Tulane was my first and only choice. Mm-hmm. Hurricane Katrina washed out my application, and seeing the news coverage really was one of the first times when I started thinking not just about myself and how I want to live my life. So I scrambled to apply to different law schools, got into a Philly one, and changing the narrative around how people are betrayed and how we frame our social issues is what led me to want to be a lawyer.
Okay. So, and you said that you said your application was washed out?
Hurricane Katrina, yeah.
Because of Tulane was hit by the 2005, hurricane.
2005, so yeah.
Wow, so that just didn't happen then.
They had a class of students that started, and they scattered them across the country to different law schools, and they deferred all their admission decisions for a year. But fortunately, one of Philadelphia's universities was starting a new law school. That's called Drexel University. And I applied there, wound up getting a full scholarship, which gave me the privilege of, when I graduated law school without debt, being able to hit the road immediately and giving back.
I mean, that's a big, give it up for full scholarships, everybody.
That's right.
Because that's a big deal. My goddaughter is applying to law school right now, and when you ask her what she wants to do with her law degree, it all comes down to, it depends how much money I owe.
Absolutely.
And that's not actually the best way to go about education in this country, but it is how we do it currently. So, but this is not your first. You're the executive director of the Pennsylvania ACLU. This is not your first go-around with the ACLU. When did you first come to work with the ACLU?
This is the first time I got paid to work for the ACLU.
Fair.
I've done lots of volunteering in my time. And one of my
Me too. Man, you must be making a lot of money on those ACLU commercials. Yeah.
When I was in law school, first, I used to be scared to go to protests. You know why?
Why?
Because I'm black and tall.
I mean, I knew the answer, but I just thought I was like, maybe it was something. Yes, yes, I
understand. So I was in school in D.C. During the buildup to the Iraq and Afghanistan's wars and the lies around. Remember when that was the worst part about our politics?
Mm-hmm.
Just lying about international wars. But that was the first time I really saw thousands of people in the street. And even then, I would be like, I'm a sneak in and walk a block with this protest. And I could see the police point at me. And I was like, yo, I need a safer way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I found out about something called legal observing. So my first interactions with the ACLU was as a legal observer. And I felt so safe with my hat and vest on, not realizing nothing. But it was really great because it let me do something I wanted to do, which was be a more engaged person in how we are having conversations on our history. And it helped me learn about this thing called the ACLU. And I like seen it in pop culture, heard about it, whatever, but I didn't really see how it applied to me. So being a legal observer in law school was cool. As I said, I was went to a new school. So I was in the first class. I don't know if you knew that, which made it very easy to start a club. You know what you needed?
What?
Two friends.
All right.
So I had two friends that also like starting clubs. So
give it up for two friends, everybody.
That's right. So here's the good part. We realized that each club got the same budget. So we created about 9 different clubs to increase our budget. And we had the best food for ACLU events because we had this bigger budget by combining those resources.
Is the statute of limitations up on telling this story? I just want to make sure you're okay.
Yeah, way past.
Okay,
way
okay,
past.
Good.
So the other really awesome way that I interacted with the ACLU, two other ways is when I graduated law school, I didn't have a job or a plan. I don't recommend that to anybody.
Yeah.
I just knew I wanted to connect my work to the internet. But eventually, I stumbled into this criminal records issue we'll probably talk about later. But one of the first organizations that collaborated with me was the ACLU and my predecessor, Reggie Shuford. Give it up for Reggie, everybody. And working with them as a small nonprofit provider was a great experience. It gives me real good perspective on how to be a good partner now. And then I was even fortunate enough to serve on the board for a few years. And that gave me additional perspective and insight into, wait, you got how many staff and y'all making all these hits? This is amazing.
So, and so for somebody who's like, you know, looking at the Philadelphia right now, what would you say as far as civil rights issues, justice issues are going on right now in Philly? What are the things you're paying attention to?
Well, in Philly, I would say we have a very sad tradition of being the poorest big city in the country. I think some of that is because we have a long history of being diverse, but neighborhood segregated, right? And even within those neighborhoods, block by block segregation. So we still haven't quite figured out how to combine all of our potential to the way we could as a governing municipality. So we have challenges with not wanting to raise taxes because people can't afford it. And as a result, the only service we pay for is police. So I would say our bigger issues are that we're trying to address is how do we have these conversations that include everybody and not just the smaller percentage of us who vote or the percentage of us that are educated or this part of town versus that part of town. One thing that's interesting is stepping into this role for ACLU of Pennsylvania is breaking down some of those artificial divides that the problems we experience in Philadelphia are completely different than the ones in Reading or the ones in Harrisburg or even crossing the mountains and getting over into the western part of the state.
And I think a lot of, someone who's born and raised here can speak to the history of you know, activism in Philadelphia and how Philly has been a leader in lots of areas of social justice. Can you talk about some of that?
Yeah. I have a great story.
Great. Everybody get ready for a great
Everybody
story.
Everybody ready for a great story. I think this is a really good example because it's so easy to talk about the cradle of liberty and leave out all of the sexism and racism and how we started and all that good stuff. But I want to take you to the year 1871. Let me know when you're there.
I'm there.
Perfect.
I don't enjoy being there, but I'm there.
Right around the Civil War, we trying to figure out what kind of country we're going to be. Lots of strong feelings. Sounds kind of familiar, right?
Strong feelings about what our country is? Okay, if you say so.
In 1871, there was a man walking around Philadelphia born of mixed race.
All right.
That happened before 1980s.
Yes.
Mixed race people.
Yeah.
This man's name is Octavius Cato, C-A-T-T-O. And he was an educator. He was an activist. One thing he was an activist about was our segregated streetcars. And at this time, they were still drawn by horses. And you know what he did?
What?
Nonviolent civil disobedience. He occupied one of these streetcars to the point in which it created so much terror that all the white people left. They unhinged the horses, what do you call it? Took the horses off the thing and just let the trolley car roll off to the side of the street. And he stayed. Overnight, and it caused such a stir amongst the communities that they finally realized we need to desegregate our trolley cars.
Wow.
But that's not what happened in 1871. This is the wild part. We're on South Street. You learned in the game show, the original southern border for Philadelphia. Two blocks east, or three blocks at 9th and South, on October the 10th, 1871, that great man I was telling you about was shot and killed by a mob of white people. You know his crime?
No.
Trying to vote. How about that? But it did, again, create a lot of stir and cause for Philadelphia to be more reflective, both around the relationship between newly arriving immigrants and African Americans, and also fast forward to 2017, created a moment of hope where we now have the Octavius Cato Memorial Statute, which in 2017 became the first statute of an African American on Philadelphia city property.
Wow.
And he's not in shackles.
Yeah.
He's not looking up to a white man or the Arthur Ashe one in Richmond raising a racket over his head, dignified.
And this 2017, I mean, I was hoping that it ended with something. Here's my question about that. Every city has stories like that. Every place in the country has stories like that of black people who did something and did not get the proper respect and also often ended up at died at the hands of violence. Is that story a story that you think every Philadelphia resident knows? Is that a story that is taught in the schools?
No, it's not taught in school. That's what I'm sharing it in this podcast, and we gotta get this podcast in the schools. But the very nice thing is the statute is next to City Hall, and City Hall is a magnificent building. Before the Eiffel Tower was built, it was the largest self-supported structure in the world.
Wow.
How about that? It also is one of the longest continuously run municipal buildings in the country. And you know what some people in Philly call it?
What?
The statue of the building with the statue of the man on top. And that man is William Penn. And the people who I've heard refer to that are some of my former clients when I was a criminal defense attorney. And it's the old courthouse.
Yeah.
And they were lost because they didn't know where the new courthouse was. So I'm at the building with the man on top. Now they could say, I'm by the Octavius Cato statue, and we get them directions to freedom.
Nice, nice. Good job. Good work there. So one thing that the ACLU is doing that you're focusing on is voter rights, getting out the vote, especially focusing on Black and brown communities where there's often a lot of voter suppression techniques that happen. Can you talk about the ACLU's work specifically here in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia to get out the vote? Because before we started, you said something before we got on. You said that the problem here isn't necessarily registration. It's getting people to go out on voting day.
That's right. Well, like I said, we don't have a registration problem. We have a turnout problem, particularly in Philadelphia, where I think we have, like, in an off-election year, maybe 12% of the people voting for really important offices. But what we're doing in Pennsylvania, and I don't use the term battleground state. If we're battleground, it's because of the American Revolution and Gettysburg and all that stuff, the violence around racial discrimination, not elections, right? We're the Keystone State. You know why we're the Keystone State? Because we're a really good reflection of the greater American culture. And part of that culture is brown people stay in big cities, and that's where the crime is, and we need to keep the crime, aka the brown people, in those big cities. The other benefit of that, though, is that there's a lot of potential for political power when you can consolidate people. But in Pennsylvania, we're taking a rather unique approach. We want to make sure we're building power in places where minorities feel more like they're minorities. And that is, for people who are familiar with Pennsylvania, places like Berks County and Lancaster County, where we particularly targeted because we think we can have a really big impact, not just with election day activities or our election protection, as we call it. 866 Our Vote, which is our election day protection work. And that's what most people think of, or where's my polling station, this and that. But what we've done in Pennsylvania is taken a much more a proactive approach to this general election cycle. We had a pre-election phase where we've done all kinds of litigation to make sure if someone makes a harmless error in their write-in ballot, that we can make sure their vote is counted and respected. Or if they make a mistake, they're notified and have an opportunity to ensure that their voice is heard. And then we're getting ready for the back end. In 2020, half of the election-related litigation was in Pennsylvania over our mail-in ballots.
I read about that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of our work is centered around not just making sure every eligible voter who is able to vote can vote and their vote is counted, but also that that count is respected and there's the least amount of election interference post-election as possible.
I mean, I would imagine somebody who's in your seat knowing that the election is coming up, but there's also the after-election and that there is talk about, there's just a lot of talk in this country about not believing election results. And a lot of that's probably going to center around this state, because this state being not a battleground state. Some people say it's a swing state, you know. What is that? How does that feel for you? Does that create anxiety in you? Are you ready for that?
Yeah, I'm ready for that. Because, listen, we've done so many scenarios. Even though we didn't plan for everything, we plan to make plans in that regard. But a better example of this is we have a voter ambassador program. Please make sure if you're in Pennsylvania, you sign up for it. And that's what keeps me chill, right? A voter ambassador program is making sure all your friends have voter plans and really creating super informed constituents in a particular neighborhood and community that everyone knows if I need accurate information, I go to Mike. And that person, we want to keep engaged in our ACLU family and break free from this election cycle work to really start building power to address the systemic issues that aren't going to be solved at elections, but are often discussed at elections.
If I gave you a magic wand and you could fix voting in America, what three things would you do?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Thank you very much.
I would ensure that every state has sufficient budget to run a free and fair election, number one. Number two, I would have some way to incentivize people to vote more consistently, like maybe a discount on your taxes if you vote three times in a row, nice. Something like that.
Like get your preferred voter's card punched?
Absolutely, man. 10% off at Macy's or something.
Some sort of Wawa gift card of some sort. I know that's not legal currently, but I'm just suggesting.
Yeah, and well, it's magic, so
yeah, no, I'm not talking law, I just feel like it's magic. I don't want anybody to be like, yeah, okay, anyway, yes, continue.
And the third thing I would do is just standardize some of the things. So Pennsylvania, for example, 67 counties set their local rules. So you would think every county would have the same number of drop boxes or the same formula for every 100,000 people you get this many drop boxes. Mm-hmm. Not true. Berks and Lancaster, what I was telling you about, guess how many drop boxes they have total?
That's a black section of Pennsylvania?
No, it is not a black part of Pennsylvania.
It is a white part of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
So that means they have one per resident.
Close.
Okay.
They have one for all, both counties combined.
Wow.
One drop box.
And who determines that?
The local board of electors.
And by my idea, and I've heard about this in Texas too, that you put the that just sort of automatically suppresses a certain amount of the vote because not everybody lives right next to that drop box and voting happens on one day and people have lives and things to do.
Absolutely. And voting happens every day, yeah. Right? We vote with our when we show up and when we don't. Mm-hmm. But I hear you on election day is when the votes get counted, yeah, and tallied the most. But it also impacts people with disabilities. So, for example, we had a great organizing effort in a place called Lebanon County, which is right next to Lancaster, also like more rural than you would think of. They were going to downgrade from 1 to 0 drop boxes, right?
That seems like not a great idea.
It does. Well,
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like 0 drop boxes is not a good number of drop boxes.
I believe in access to your rights. Yes. And if you got the right to vote, we should be making it easier for you to access it, like how easy we make it to access firearms. Like, come on.
Yes, yes, yes.
Want me to repeat that? It should be easier to access your vote than it is to access a firearm. And in Lebanon County, they went from 1 to 0. We found out about it, ACLU Pennsylvania, and fortunately for us, they violated the Sunshine Act, so they had to do a redo. And they thought they were just going to walk into an empty room and pass the whatever again. Mm-hmm. And we showed up. We showed out, and they had to reconsider their decision. And now, thankfully, there's at least one drop box in Lebanon County. So I just told you about 3 counties in Pennsylvania, 12.9 million people total in the whole Commonwealth, and 3 of our counties have 2 drop boxes between them.
What can people who are listening, people in this room, do to support voter rights in Pennsylvania or voter rights wherever they live? What would you recommend? If you could give people homework, what homework would you give them?
Well, if you live in Pennsylvania and you like what you've heard, please go to aclupa.org/volunteer. As I said, we have a voter ambassador program. We have a whole ladder of engagement. So if all you have capacity for is making phone calls, you can do that. If you have lots of time and can show up places, you can do that. And then at the national level, just make sure everybody has a plan to vote who is eligible. We talk to people about the importance of consistent voting. And just to speak more specifically to people of color, I know it doesn't feel like voting works, especially in the immediate sense, but there's a long-term payout to selling people you're not going away, right? And the more we vote collectively, the more we say we're not going away. So part of what we're doing in Pennsylvania is a very intentional engagement of communities of color on radio stations owned by people of color, newspapers by people of color, to really hammer home the idea that the power that we have as citizens is best expressed through the mother of rights, and that's voting. And if you want to give birth to other rights that are important to you, respect your mom and go vote.
Give it up for Mike Lee, everybody. Executive Director of the Pennsylvania ACLU. Give it up for Mike Lee.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of At Liberty. To see more content from the bus tour and learn about the ACLU's fight for voting rights this election season, visit the episode description. And if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. And since you're a good person, give it a good rating and a good review. We really appreciate the feedback. And stay tuned for our next episode live from the Detroit stop of the bus tour. Until then, I'm W. Kamau Bell. And even after that, I'm W. Kamau Bell. And remember, as always, friends, don't let friends not vote.
Produced by Vanessa Handy, Gwen Schroeder, Jessica Weitz, and Abdul Corlett for ACLU. W. Kamau Bell, Kelly Rafferty, and Melissa Hudson Bell for Who Knows Best Productions. Post-production services are provided by Ultraviolet with mixing and sound design by Peter Bonaventure.